The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Doris Hyde from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times Don't Ignore Privacy Policy Updates by Ming Wong, and also from the New York Times A Foe for Type 1 Diabetes by Anahad O'Connor. From Sports Illustrated 1996, Don Wardlow's Exceptional Vision by Mark Wexler, along with the commentary that Don Wardlow posted on his Extra Innings web on May 28th. Mashable.com has posted an update about doctors perform gene therapy treatment on boy with inherited blindness called Luxturna. Today's reading of Vision News is underwritten by an anonymous gift in loving memory of Joe and Kelly. Don't ignore that flood of privacy policy updates from Min Wong for the New York Times. You have probably noticed a flood of emails and alerts from companies recently informing you about changes to their privacy policies. Don't ignore them. You have probably noticed a flood of emails and alerts. Yes, there is a lot of legalese to wade through, but resist the temptation to immediately delete those emails or close the alerts right away. They may contain important information about managing your digital privacy at a time when it's become clear that our online data is far from safe. All those privacy messages are appearing now because a law called the General Data Protection Regulation was set to go into effect across the European Union Friday. The law has been heralded as the world's strongest protector of digital privacy rights. And while it was designed for Europeans, the borderless nature of the online world has virtually every commercial entity that touches the web making changes to its sites and apps to comply. The data regulation law centers on two main principles. The first is that companies need your consent to collect your data. The second is that you should be required to share only data that is necessary to make their services work. Danny O'Brien, a director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, offered this analogy. A birthday cake company needs your name to put on the birthday cake. If it isn't essential information, you can deny them consent to use that data, and you still get to have to get the service. If companies don't comply with the new rules, they can be fined up to 4% of their global revenue. But you should expect businesses that rely on advertising revenue to work hard to persuade as many of us as possible to give our consent for them to collect as much data as possible. Companies can do that by making it easy for people to give permission and immensely complicated to opt out. So to ensure you benefit from the new law, it helps to examine the revamped privacy policies we are all getting. Here's what to look for. Companies want your consent. Let's start with those pesky emails and notifications. Don't gloss over them. Some sites are using the emails not only to inform you of their updated privacy policies, but also to, quote, ask, unquote, for your consent. For example, Quora, the questions and answers site, sent an email last week saying that its privacy policy had been updated. Toward the end of the note, it tucked in a note that your continued use of the service will be considered acceptance of our updated terms. A Quora spokeswoman said that in compliance with the new data law, the company sought affirmative consent from users. The company said the email explaining the particular changes in its privacy policy did not require consent, but noted that it would update the language in its email to be less ambiguous. Other sites are using pop-up notifications to seek consent. Here's the problem. Companies clearly know that we rarely, if ever, read privacy policies. They also know that we find notifications to be annoying, because they pop up just as we are in the middle of another task. But if we ignore them, we may be unintentionally giving consent to more of our data being shared than we actually want to give out. That pop-up fatigue is definitely something that I'm worried about now that these pop-ups are really more important than ever, said Jenny Gebhardt, a researcher who follows privacy issues for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Find the new privacy controls. If you skipped reading the emails and notifications, you may have missed out on the new privacy controls that internet companies recently introduced. These typically are not very easy to find, but they are worth exploring because there may be new methods methods to minimize the amount of data you share. Consider Twitter. The social media company's recent privacy-related email mentioned that people can now more clearly see and control how their data is shared with its business partners. Here's how. Near the very bottom of Twitter's settings menu, there is now a button called Your Twitter Data. Here, you can see the number of advertisers that are trying to target you based on your interests. You can also opt out of the so-called interest-based advertising. When I used the tool, I found that more than 600 advertisers had my contact information, and I chose to no longer share data with the ads program. Facebook, which has been under scrutiny for the improper harvesting of user data by the political profiling firm Cambridge Analytica, has also updated its privacy controls. One of Facebook's newer tools is called Privacy Checkup, which can be found in a menu called Privacy Shortcuts. When you run the checkup with the Facebook app, it quickly walks you through the people you share your posts with by default, the information you show on your profile, and the apps that you share your data with. Also inside the Facebook app's settings menu is a button labeled Ads. This brings you to your ad preferences, where you can see which advertisers have your contact information, and you can control the types of ads that can be shown to you. You can always leave. A big part of the new data law is that it requires companies to offer ways for you to pull your data out and take it to a new service. Google, Facebook, and Twitter each offer the ability to download your own data, and some of those capabilities have been expanded ahead of the new data laws going into effect. Be aware that other internet products you use should soon be offering similar tools to pull out your data. If you disagree with the company's new data collection policy, try downloading your information to see if you can exercise your right of taking your data to a better product. But beware, not all data portability tools are created equal. I documented my experience downloading my data from Google and Facebook and found that Google's data porting tool called Takeout was superior to Facebook's. Google gave greater transparency into the information that was gathered, and it gave more options for the data I could move to competing products. And if porting your data doesn't work out, keep in mind that you can delete your account. The new data law requires companies to offer ways for European users to permanently delete their accounts and all their data along with it. Companies may choose not to offer the same option for people outside Europe, but it won't hurt to try. Also from the New York Times, by Anna Hod O'Connor, a foe for type 1 diabetes. Like many children, Andrew Hightower, 13, likes pizza, sandwiches, and dessert. But Andrew has type 1 diabetes, and 6 years ago, to control his blood sugar levels, his parents put him on a low-carbohydrate, high-protein diet. His mother makes him recipes with diabetic-friendly ingredients that won't spike his blood sugar, such as pizza with a low-carb almond flour crust and homemade bread with walnut flour instead of white flour. Andrew's diet requires careful planning. He often takes his own meals to school, but he and his parents say it makes it easier to manage his condition, and since he started the diet, his blood sugar control has markedly improved, and he has had no complications requiring hospital visits. "I do this so that I can be healthy," said Andrew, who lives with his parents in Jacksonville, Florida, adding that he will keep following the diet when I eventually move out and go to college. Most diabetes experts do not recommend low-carb diets for people with type 1 diabetes, especially children. Some worry that restricting carbs can lead to dangerously low blood sugar levels, a condition known as hypoglycemia, and potentially stunt growth. But a new study published in the journal Pediatrics suggests otherwise. It found that children and adults with type 1 diabetes who followed a very low-carb, high-protein diet for an average of just over 2 years, combined with the diabetes drug insulin at smaller doses than typically required on a normal diet, had exceptional blood sugar control. They had low rates of major complications, and children who followed it for years did not show any signs of impaired growth. The study found that the participants' average hemoglobin A1c, a long-term barometer of blood sugar levels, fell to just 5.67%. An A1c under 5.7 is considered normal, and it is well below the threshold for diabetes, which is 6.5%. Their blood sugar control seemed almost too good to be true, said Belinda Lenners, the study's lead author and a pediatric endocrinology instructor at Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. It's nothing we typically see in the clinic for type 1 diabetes. The new study comes with an important caveat. It was an observational study, not a randomized trial, with a control group. The researchers recruited 316 people, 130 of them children whose parents gave consent, from a Facebook group dedicated to low-carb diets for diabetes called Type 1 Grit. Perhaps the surprise is that for this large number of patients, a very low-carb diet is much safer than many experts would have suggested, said David M. Harlan of the University of Massachusetts Medical School, who was not involved in the study. This paper, Harlan added, should reopen the discussion about whether this is something we should be offering our patients as a therapeutic approach. The paper's authors cautioned that the findings should not lead patients to alter their diabetes management without consulting their doctors, and that large clinical trials will be needed to see whether this approach should be used more widely. We think that the findings point the way to a potentially exciting new treatment option, said Dr. David Ludwig, a co-author of the study and a pediatric endocrinologist at Boston Children's Hospital, who has written popular books about low-carb diets. However, because our study was observational, the results should not by themselves justify a change in diabetes management. About 1.25 million Americans have type 1 diabetes, which occurs when the pancreas does not produce enough insulin to regulate blood sugar levels. Managing the condition requires administering insulin throughout the day, especially when consuming meals high in carbs, which raise blood sugar more than other nutrients. Over time, chronically elevated blood sugar can lead to nerve and kidney damage and cardiovascular disease. The standard approach for people with type 1 diabetes is to match carb intake with insulin, but the argument for restricting carbs is that it keeps blood sugar more stable and requires less insulin, resulting in fewer highs and lows. The approach has not been widely studied or embraced for type 1 diabetes, but some patients swear by it. Type 1 Grit has about 3,000 members on Facebook, who ascribe to a program devised by Dr. Richard Bernstein, an 84-year-old physician with type 1 diabetes. His book, Dr. Bernstein's Diabetes Solution, recommends limiting daily carb intake to about 30 grams, the amount in a sweet potato, or about 4 or 5 cups of cooked broccoli. Bernstein recommends foods such as non-starchy vegetables, seafood, nuts, meat, yogurt, tofu, and recipes made with almond flour, sugar substitutes, and other low glycemic ingredients. His plan emphasizes protein intake, which he says is especially important for growing children. The most striking finding of the new report was that A1C levels on average fell from 7.15% in the diabetic range to 5.67%, which is normal. The rate of diabetes-related hospitalizations also fell from 8% before the diet to 2% after, including fewer hospitalizations for hypoglycemic seizures. Those following the diet had increased LDL cholesterol, most likely from consuming more saturated fat, which some experts said was potentially concerning and deserved further study. But other heart disease risk factors appeared favorable. They had high HDL cholesterol, the protective kind, and low triglycerides, a type of fat in the blood linked to heart disease. Dr. Joyce Lee, a diabetes expert at the University of Michigan who was not involved in the study, said that the findings were impressive and merited further follow-up, and that patients who wanted to explore a low-carb approach might do so while being monitored by their healthcare team. But she also noted that the patients in the new study were a highly motivated group, and that it would be difficult for many people to adopt the restrictive regimen they followed. The reality is that it's really hard to do low-carb, given our cultural norms, said Lee, a professor of pediatrics at the University of Michigan. In an interview, Bernstein, a co-author on the paper, said it demonstrates what he sees in his practice, that there are diabetics on his regimen who are walking around with normal blood sugars, and they are happy about it, healthy, and growing if they are kids. Derek Rollerson, 46, a human resources manager in Alabama, agrees. Both he and his son, Connor, 13, have type 1 diabetes. Rollerson said he struggled for years to control his blood sugar, but 6 years ago he gave up juice, bread, potatoes, and other simple carbs, and made protein and non-starchy vegetables the focus of his meals. Since going low carb, he said, he has lost weight, cut in half the amount of insulin he uses daily, and watched his A1C fall from the diabetic range to normal levels. I have normalized steady blood sugars now, he said. I am no longer on the roller coaster. Exceptional vision. Don Wardlow can't see, but fans listening on the radio are never in the dark. By Mark Wexler for SportsIllustrated.com in 1996, published July 8th. Slouched behind the press box table, Don Wardlow adjusts his sunglasses and leans into his microphone. Live from New Britain Stadium, he exclaims, Rock Cats Radio is on the air. On the field below, the starting pitcher for the AA farm team of the Minnesota Twins jogs to the mound and begins warming up. Wardlow, however, can't see him. In fact, as he announces the starting lineups for today's Eastern League game between the hometown Hardware City Rock Cats and the visiting Portland Sea Dogs, Wardlow can't see any of the players or any of the 2,500 New Britain, Connecticut fans filling their seats. For that matter, Wardlow can't even see the seats, but that doesn't stop him from describing the scene for his radio listeners. It's a beautiful day for baseball, he says, beaming. Then turning to his broadcast partner, play-by-play announcer Jim Lucas, he whispers, Sun's still out, right? As the first blind radio announcer in professional baseball history, Wardlow relies on instinct, wit, razor-sharp hearing, his partner's exhaustive preparation, and his faithful guide dog Gizmo to perform his duties as color commentator with Lucas. The two men have been the official voice of the Eastern League franchise for four seasons. During that time, they have established their own regional baseball and radio network, buying an airtime and selling all of the commercials which they produce themselves. What they've accomplished is unique in baseball, says Andy Young, announcer for the rival Sea Dogs. If this is a dream, please don't wake me until the season's over, adds Wardlow. I'm having too much fun. For Wardlow, the dream began with a nightmare 33 years ago in Matuchin, New Jersey. The youngest of five children, he was born without eyes, a condition that occurs in roughly one of every 100,000 births. You're never prepared for a shock like this, says Don's mother, Peg Wardlow. The doctors couldn't explain it. Wardlow's introduction to baseball came 8 years later when he listened for the first time to a New York Mets game on the radio. A year later, his father took him to a game at Shea Stadium. I still remember the sounds, the crack of the bat, the pop of the catcher's mitt, the roar of the crowd, says Wardlow, who was introduced to Mets announcer Bob Murphy that day. From that moment on, I was hooked, says Wardlow. While the players were gods to all the other kids, my idols were the broadcasters. Wardlow began recording games from the radio and listening to them over and over again. Not far away in Skillman, New Jersey, another youngster was also dreaming of becoming a big league radio broadcaster. Lucas, a year older, says, I was fanatical about announcing, even going so far as to narrate our trips to the supermarket. Mom is now passing the broccoli in aisle two. Lucas eventually enrolled as a communications major at Glassboro State College in southern New Jersey, and while he was announcing a game, another student approached him. Are you up for a challenge? Asked Wardlow as he introduced himself. Would you announce baseball games with a blind guy? Wardlow had been rejected by all of the other student broadcasters. Clearly Don knew baseball, says Lucas. He just wanted a chance to approve himself. Who was I to say no? The partnership and a friendship started. After college, Lucas worked for a collection agency, while Wardlow became a quality control technician for Recording for the Blind, a Princeton-based group that records books for the vision impaired. On weekends, the two baseball fanatics traveled to Major League stadiums in New York City and Philadelphia, where they sat in the upper decks and practiced calling the action into a tape recorder. In 1990, after 7 years of practicing together, Lucas and Wardlow decided they were ready. They sent audition tapes to every professional baseball team in the country, from the minor leagues to the majors. Only one team called them back. I thought if they were crazy enough to spend all those years practicing announcing up in the cheap seats at Yankee Stadium, then they deserved a chance, says Mike Veek, president of a Class A team then based in Miami, and called appropriately enough the miracle. Veeck, whose father was the legendary owner and promoter Bill Veeck, invited Lucas and Wardlow down to Florida in July to do a game. 5 months later, Veeck offered the broadcasters a job for the following season. Sure, they provided a publicity gimmick for our team, but I wouldn't have hired them if they didn't have talent, says Veeck. The duo announced miracle games throughout the 1991 and 92 seasons. Then Lucas heard about a Double-A team in Connecticut that was not broadcasting its games. Jim came to me with an offer I couldn't refuse, says Jerry Bertheum, general manager of what was then the New Britain Red Sox, a Boston farm team. Most minor league teams pay broadcasters a salary, but Lucas offered to do New Britain's games at no cost to the franchise. His plan? He and Wardlow would buy their own airtime on a regional radio station, then sell their own commercials to pay for it. In 1993, the pair began preparing for its first season in Double-A ball. There was only one problem. No one wanted to buy ads for our broadcast, says Wardlow. So he and Lucas came up with another scheme. Advertisers would pay for their commercials only if New Britain won. It was a clever idea, but the team lost its first 12 games. We knew we wouldn't get rich announcing minor league ball, but this was ridiculous, says Lucas. Fortunately, Gizmo, Wardlow's black Labrador, had attracted one sponsor, the IAMS Pet Food Company, which was willing to pay win or lose. The Red Sox finished with a 52-88 record in 1993, and Lucas and Wardlow cleared about $5,000. The following year, they fared only slightly better. In 1995, New Britain joined the Minnesota Twins farm system and changed its name to the Hardware City Rockcats in honor of New Britain's reputation as the tool-making capital of the country. This season, the Rockcats moved into a sparkling new stadium, though they still have a losing record. Wardlow, meanwhile, has built up a following throughout the 10 Eastern League cities. Don is an inspiration wherever we go, says Sean Gavigan, a Rockcats relief pitcher. When we're on the road, he and Gizmo always attract a crowd. When the team travels, Lucas takes Wardlow on a practice run through the hotel, so Wardlow knows how to lead Gizmo outside when nature calls. On one visit to Binghamton, New York, however, Lucas went to sleep before showing Wardlow around. Gizmo had to go, so Don went down to the lobby on his own, recalls Lucas. But instead of going outside, Wardlow made a wrong turn and wound up in the middle of a wedding reception in the hotel's ballroom. After I figured out where I was, I asked the bride for a dance, says Wardlow. In each preseason, Lucas spends hours dictating statistics and personal information about every player in the league into a tape recorder. Wardlow then translates all of the material into Braille paper that he can refer to while broadcasting. Before each game, Lucas records updated statistics for the two teams, and Wardlow spends about 3 hours organizing the material. Their work ethic is second to none, says Portland's Young. Don may be the best prepared color commentator in baseball. During the seventh inning stretch of today's game against the Sea Dogs, Wardlow leans out of the press box window holding the public address announcer's microphone and asks the fans to join him in singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. The crowd reacts with gusto. Never in my wildest dreams could I have imagined all of this, says Lucas. I'll sometimes look over at Don during a game, and he'll have his back to home plate announcing to a blank wall, and I'll crack up on the air. Here's a guy born without eyes announcing a baseball game on the radio, and I'm there beside him. Someday we hope to be doing it full-time in the major leagues. It is the stuff fairy tales are made of, and his fairy tale, says Wardlow, is still coming true. I just may be the luckiest blind man on earth. Mark Wexler lives in Washington, D.C., and is the editor of National Wildlife Magazine. From BaseballAsICSeeIt.com, Don Wardlow says, Extra Inning Duel brings out the best in playoff teams. Written on May 28th, 2018. Hi all, here's how I see baseball on Monday, May 28th. Sometimes when playoff teams collide, you get a special game even on an ordinary day. That's what happened yesterday in Cleveland when the defending champion Astros faced the Indians. It took 14 innings for a decision to be reached, and it took the best effort of Indians rookie Greg Allen to give his team the 10-9 win. Allen's home run was just the final act of a drama that took most of yesterday to play out. Early on, it seemed like the Astros' Jose Altuve had salted away another game for his team. He had four hits before being retired in the ninth. The four hits brought him to a total of 10 hits in as many at-bats, an incredible feat. It looked like the Astros would be 15 games above the 500 mark. Going to the last of the ninth, the Astros had an 8-3 lead, the result of scoring six runs in the eighth. The Indians rallied to tie the contest, with the charge being capped off by an RBI single by Michael Brantley, which tied the game at 8-8. In the 13th, in a sign of the times we live in now, each side hit a solo home run. For the Astros' part, it was Evan Gattis, and on the Indians' side, it was Yonder Alonso hitting a solo home run to level the game. Brad Peacock came in to face the Indians in the 14th. He only fired one salvo, a pitch which the Tribe Greg Allen took out of the park. The team are 26-25, a game above 500. Allen, 25, hit just his second home run as a big leaguer, and hit it at the best possible time for the club, which drafted him in round 6 of the 2014 draft. He studied at San Diego State, as did the Nationals' Steven Strasburg a few seasons earlier. His first home run was hit last September while Allen was a late call-up. The Astros got 7 strong innings from Garrett Cole, their late acquisition from the Pirates. He gave up 4 hits and 3 runs in an excellent start. The bullpen didn't cover themselves with glory, particularly Ken Giles. 2 starters had to be called in, Colin McHugh and Brad Peacock. For the Indians, Trevor Bauer struck out 13 men and lasted as long as the 8th inning, but gave up 4 runs in doing so. Evan Marshall followed Bauer to the hill but couldn't get a man out. All 3 men he saw got base hits and ultimately scored after he had been removed. The unfortunate Marshall now carries an ERA of nearly 17. A life in the bullpen can do that. Ben Taylor gave up the 8th run. The next 3 relievers got by until Dan Otero gave up the home run to Gattis. He was redeemed by Alonso's home run and then got the Astros out in the 14th to claim the win when Allen hit his home run. As today is Memorial Day, a number of games will be played this afternoon. When this was a new holiday, which was called Decoration Day, split doubleheaders were common. A game in the morning, another in the afternoon. The Pirates were the last to hold on to the tradition of morning games on holidays. The Astros don't get any rest after yesterday's marathon. They have to move on and play the Yankees in the Bronx. Only 4 games will be played at night, and one of those is a makeup game between the Mets and Braves because of a rainout last month. The 2 teams also have an afternoon game on the slate. The latest game will start at 8 Eastern, 5 Pacific in Los Angeles, where the Phillies and Dodgers have to deal with the shadows as well as the pitches from the opposition. Signed, Don Wardlow. The Baseball As I See It homepage has this commentary by Don Wardlow in introduction. Hi all, as we prepare for the new season, a few words about the guy behind the tilted takes you'll be reading here. I've been a baseball lover since 1971 at age 8. I fell hard for the game, though I have been blind since birth. For a dozen years, I was baseball's first blind broadcaster. With Jim Lucas on play-by-play, I rode the buses around the minors, staying in cheap motels and eating at Waffle Houses when necessary. At age 39, I took a different direction in my life, but baseball remains in my blood. I have now returned to my roots in New Jersey, from where I write this column. Check it out anytime and share with other fans. In December of 2017, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals applied for and the FDA accepted a supplemental biologics license application for a 12-week, 3-month dosing interval of Eylea for patients with wet age-related macular degeneration. Regeneron reported that an integrated analysis of 2-year results from the VIEW 1 and VIEW 2 Phase 3 trials found that 51% of patients who had dosing intervals extended to every 12 weeks at the beginning of the second year kept their best corrected visual acuity gains. Increasing the time between injections and visits to the eye doctor is welcome news for those with wet AMD. To learn more, go to wet macular degeneration treatment using anti-VEGF medications. We've run out of time for today's episode of Vision News. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Doris Hyde reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradingservice.org.